Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's premier public affairs forum, brought to you from the San Francisco Marriott Hotel in downtown San Francisco. I'm Mary Bitterman, your quarterly chair. We welcome the listeners of KRNW-FM in Chillicothe, Montana, one of over 225 public radio stations tuned into America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners to join us at the Commonwealth Club whenever they're visiting San Francisco, and we also invite you to visit the club's website on the internet. And now to the introduction of our distinguished guest. A 1957 visit to Kenya made all the difference. It was in that year that Jane Goodall traveled to Africa with a friend and met the famed anthropologist Dr. Louis Leakey, beginning a lifelong study of wild chimpanzees to gain insight into the evolutionary past of humans. In fact, Dr. Goodall's work has laid the foundation for all primate research, bringing to bear the many similarities between humans and chimpanzees. In 1977, Dr. Goodall founded the Jane Goodall Institute for Wildlife Research, Education, and Conservation to provide ongoing support for field research and to heighten global awareness of the interdependence of all life. She's also founded Roots and Shoots, an international environmental education program for young people, which allows them to learn that their daily actions make a difference to the world around them, the environment and the animal community, both human and non-human. With a PhD in ethology from Cambridge University, Dr. Goodall is the recipient of numerous honorary degrees and awards, including the National Geographic Society's prestigious Hubbard Medal, given in 1995, for her extraordinary 35-year study of wild chimpanzees and for tirelessly defending the natural world we share. It is my great pleasure now to present to you Dr. Jane Goodall.
Well, thank you and good afternoon, everybody. I think when one addresses a group of people like this and you have to stand up after being introduced, well, I always think of that fable where, you know, the birds have a contest which one can fly the highest, and the mighty eagle is quite sure that he's going to win the contest, and he flies higher and higher. Gradually, all the other birds drop back. But when he's reached the limit of his endurance, up from his back flies a little wren and wins the contest. And I like to think of my progress through life as being riding on an eagle, because none of us get very far by ourselves, and all of us have eagles who help us on our way. There are so many amazing people who've been around me to support me, to help me, to advise me ever since the beginning. Fantastic students and other field staff at Gombe National Park helping to collect up this data, some of whom are still out there today, some of whom are busy analyzing and working out results from this amazing long-term record, 37 years now. And then there are so many friends, people who take me in when I'm traveling on one of these crazy lecture tours. There are the staff of the Jane Goodall Institute, and one of those is here today, Mary Lewis. Mary Lewis is traveling with me, trying to get me around this seven-week tour, among many other things that she does. And you really do need to thank Mary for the fact that I'm here today, because I don't think I would be but for her. And there are two trustees here. There's Paul Case with his wife Maureen, who's a local trustee. And then a very, very special person is Jenny Di San Faustino, who's up here, the second from your, what are you, left, second from your left at the high table. And Jenny's the one who started the the Institute here in San Francisco back in 1976. We were talking about it. So another very special person. And then, of course, there's my family. And it wouldn't be nice if I didn't start off by acknowledging my enormous debt to my mother. She's been there for me consistently from the very beginning. I spoke to her this morning. She's 93. She broke her hip, but she's walking again. And she said, oh, I wish I could be there. She wants to be with Jenny. And she also said, well, say hello from me to all those people out there. So hello from Mum. It's absolutely true that I wouldn't be here without her in many ways. When I was just a little tiny thing, mad about animals like so many children, I had the wonderful excitement of going to stay with my father's family on a farm. And we lived in London at the time. And there for the first time I met cows and horses and pigs, and it was fabulous. But one of my jobs was to collect hen's eggs. And you know, when you're a kid, you play this game where there's a board with different shaped holes, and you get pegs and you fit them into the right shaped hole. So as I collected these eggs every day, where was the hole big enough on the hen for the egg to come out? I couldn't see one. So apparently I asked everybody, and obviously none of them explained it properly. So I worked out my very first animal observation. I hid in a little stuffy hen house, because there were no cruel battery farms in those days. And I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. My family called the police. They didn't know where I was. And as dusk was falling and the police were on their way, my mother, out there searching, saw this excited little creature rushing towards the house covered with straw. And she didn't reprimand me. She saw the excitement and sat down to hear the story of how a hen lays an egg. And as I was growing up, I met Dr. Doolittle, and then came Tarzan. When I was 10 years old, I was madly in love with Tarzan, terribly jealous of Tarzan's Jane, thought I'd have been a much better mate for Tarzan myself. Well, I would, don't you think? So when I was 10 years old, I was dreaming about going to Africa and living with animals and writing books about them. But we're going back now 50 years. We're going to a very different world. It was towards the end of the Second World War in Europe. Africa was the dark continent. We heard rumors, really, coming from that dark continent about poisoned arrows and drumbeats sending out sinister messages through the jungles, all kinds of things like that. But there were also all those wonderful animals, and I suppose I thought there was Tarzan out there somewhere, too. And in addition to all that, we didn't have any money. I mean, we couldn't afford a car. I couldn't have a bicycle. We had enough to eat. And so my mother's friends would say to her, why don't you tell Jane to dream about something she can achieve? She can't go and live with animals in Africa. Nobody did in those days. But you see, what my mother said was that if you really want something and you work hard enough and you take advantage of opportunity and you never give up, you find a way. And so even though I couldn't go directly to university from school because we couldn't afford the fees and to get a scholarship, you had to be good in another language, and I simply wasn't able to learn any other language. In fact, there's only one language I've ever been able to learn fairly well. And just so that you shan't think I'm a complete simpleton, I will greet you in chimpanzee. So anyway, my mother said, well, Jane, if you do a secretarial course, you can be a secretary anywhere in the world. So I did my course, got a job in London, had a letter from a school friend whose parents had moved to Kenya. The opportunity, would I go and stay? Well, still no money. So I gave up my lovely job with documentary films, and I went and lived at home for free, and I worked as a waitress, and I saved up my wages and my tips until I had enough for a return fare to Africa. Not by plane, because in those days planes were new and rather expensive to carry passengers, but by one of the good old boats. So off I went, age 23. Then I heard about the late Louis Leakey and went to visit him at the Natural History Museum. And he took me around and asked me so many questions. And you see, because I'd gone on reading books about animals in Africa, I could answer most of the questions. Gave me a job. He let me go with himself, his wife, and one other young English girl onto the now famous Olduvai Gorge. But in those days, it wasn't famous because no early human remains had been found, no fossil humans. And so there wasn't a road, there wasn't a trail, there was nothing. It was wild, untouched Africa. And so many animals in those days. And every day after the hard day's work, Gillian and I were allowed to walk out onto the plains among the animals. And, you know, gazelle and giraffe and zebra, and one night a rhino. One evening, two young male lions came and followed about twice the length of this room, which was a bit scary but terribly exciting. And every morning when I woke up, I was in my dream. What magic. And that was when Louis Leakey realized, he says, that he'd found the person he'd been looking for many years, someone to go and try and find out something about the behavior of our closest living relatives in their natural habitat. He didn't even know then how closely related to us chimpanzees were, but it was thought that they were very, very close. And he believed that learning something about their behavior would help him to have a better feeling for how our own ancestors may have behaved. So off I went, but there were two problems to overcome. First of all, how did he get money for a young, untrained girl? Most people thought he was amoral, but finally a wealthy American businessman said, "All right, Lewis, here you are, enough money for 6 months." And then the British authorities, because Tanzania, where this study is, was Tanganyika in those days, a British protectorate. A young girl out on her own in the bush, said the British officials, impossible, preposterous. But eventually they agreed that if I took a companion, that it would be all right. So for the first 3 months, who came with me but that same remarkable mother? And she brought simple medicines with her and set up a clinic. And because she cared about people, even though she wasn't a medical person, she made wonderful cures. She was known as a white witch doctor and established a terrific relationship with the local people that stood me in good stead ever since. So that's how the study began. And why are we still studying the chimpanzees today after 37 years? And what sort of things have we found out? Well, we certainly have found out how like us they are, not only in their biology, in the structure of the DNA. They differ from us by only just over 1%, which says something about the length of time that we've been separated on our evolutionary journey from an ape-like, human-like creature. And we know that the blood and immune system of chimpanzees is more like ours than that of any other living creature, which is why they are used by some scientists to try and learn more about human infectious diseases, searching for cures and vaccines. The brain and central nervous system of the chimpanzee is also uncannily like ours. So it's logical to assume, because of that, that we would expect to find similarities in social behavior, in intellectual performance, and in emotional response. But when I began in 1960, the scientific attitude of the time was very hard. When we were studying ethology, the study of behavior, we couldn't talk about personalities. Only humans had personalities. Animals couldn't reason. They didn't have minds. Only humans could do that. And above all, it was a terrible sin to talk about emotions in animals. Only humans had emotions like joy and sorrow and fear and despair. Only humans were capable of feeling emotional as well as physical pain. But fortunately, you see, I hadn't been to university when I went out in the field. I didn't know those things. So instead of numbering the chimpanzees, I gave them names. And I described their vivid personalities. Many of you know about Flo and Fifi and Figgin and Passion and some of the other ones who have been made very famous around the world today, largely thanks to the National Geographic Society. And I described how chimpanzees used and made tools in a seemingly very reasoned way. And that was an amazing observation, because at that time, we were described as man the toolmaker. The fact that we used and made tools, it was thought, differentiated us more than anything else from the rest of the animal kingdom. It was that observation that brought the National Geographic in the first place to continue the funding when that original seed money disappeared. So Over these years at Gombe, we've learned such amazing things. We've charted the life histories and family histories of these amazing chimpanzee beings. A little story. A young female, 9 years old, is walking along a forest trail. She's followed by her 3-year-old brother. He's a little bit tottery on his feet. The mother's way behind. It's dim and green and brown, and the ferns are up beside the trail and the vines hanging down. And suddenly, Pom, the adolescent, stops and she stares at something just down beside the trail. Ooh. 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 And her hair stands up a little, which is a sign of fear, and she rushes up the tree. Well, her little brother doesn't hear the sound, or he doesn't know what it means, and he comes closer and closer to this thing at the side of the trail. And as Pom is watching, every hair bristles with fright, and she gets this big grin of fear on her face, and finally she can't stand it any longer, so she rushes down, picks up little Prof, and climbs back up the tree. And there, coiled up at the side of the trail, is a big poisonous snake. And that's just one example of ways in which chimpanzees behave like us. In their non-verbal communication, they kiss, they embrace, they hold hands, they pat one another on the back, they swagger when they're angry, they shake their fists, they tickle with their fingers. And they don't just show these behaviors that are so like ours in any old context, they show them in context which are very similar, sometimes identical, to those in which we show them ourselves. They're capable of sophisticated cooperation. They're hunters and they share prey. They're capable of true altruism. They understand the needs of others. They show emotions we all believe who've worked with chimpanzees for any length of time, similar to joy, sorrow, fear, despair. They can actually die of grief, like a youngster of 8 whose mother died, just gave up, showed symptoms like clinical depression in young human children who've been orphaned. And in this situation, with his immune system weakened, he fell sick and was dead within a month of losing his mother, and that was Flo and Flint. And we've seen so many other things like this. We've recorded so many amazing stories. I could story tell for you for the next hour and a half. And it's a fascinating occupation, but we don't have time for it. The problem today is that chimpanzees are disappearing very, very fast across Africa, which is where they live. And their treatment in captivity around the world is sometimes extremely harsh and cruel. At the turn of the century, it's estimated that there were way over 1 million chimpanzees extending across this central equatorial forest belt from the west coast to the western parts of Tanzania, Uganda, and so on. Well, at the very most today, there are 250,000 chimpanzees remaining. There isn't a forest belt anymore. It's a series of fragmented patches of forest. These 250,000, 250,000, are in 21 countries stretched across Africa. And many of them are in very small, fragmented populations where the gene pool is so small that it's almost certain that their long-term future is doomed. That's the case for the chimpanzees I've been studying all these years in the Gombe National Park. It's a tiny national park. It's 30 square miles. There are 3 separate communities of about 50 chimps each inside that park. And outside now, on 3 sides, the park is surrounded by cultivation, and on the 4th side is Lake Tanganyika. So that little population, 140, 150 chimpanzees, is so small that if major epidemics continue to sweep through those numbers, as they sometimes do, then, and also with the effects of inbreeding, then that population is doomed as well. There are 2 other major threats facing chimpanzees in addition to habitat destruction. First of all, hunting for the live animal trade. Secondly, hunting for food. There is not so much hunting for the live animal trade today, but hunting for food has become a very serious problem threatening chimpanzees in parts of West and Central Africa. You see, the hunters used to practice subsistence hunting. They would go out in the forest, they'd shoot a few animals to feed themselves and their families. But today it's different. And it's mainly because of the logging companies. The logging companies come in and they make roads deep into the heart of the remaining rainforests of Africa. And that opens the forest up to settlement, and it also opens it up to hunting. And when these trucks bring out the last great giant forest trees destroyed by modern technology in just a few minutes, they bear also the cut up and dried remains of countless animals of all species, including chimpanzees and gorillas. And it's not going to feed the villagers now. It's become a commerce. It's become commercialized. And these meat remains are sent off into the town, sometimes very long distances, on the trucks belonging to the logging companies. Logging companies aren't African-owned. The logging companies belong to industrialized corporations coming from North America, coming from Canada, coming from various parts of Europe, Japan, and more recently Indonesia. These are the countries that are raping the last of Africa's rainforests, very often just so that we can buy tropical hardwood furniture because we think it looks nice and the wood's hard and it gives us a status symbol. So when the chimpanzees are sold for meat, very often mothers are shot and the baby is sold in a market because there's not much meat on a chimpanzee of that age. So the hunter hopes a few extra dollars will be gained by selling the chimpanzee. Maybe somebody's sorry for it. And I'll never forget the first infant I saw like that, because I went up to him. He was surrounded by a great crowd of people. He was dehydrated, sweating under the hot sun. His eyes were glazed. I knelt down beside him, and I made the little sound, which is chimpanzee greeting, and to my amazement, he sat up, reached out, and touched my face. Well, I was in a dilemma, because if you buy them, there's a chance that the hunter will deliberately go and shoot mothers in order to sell babies. But how could I abandon him? Fortunately, in the Congo, as in so many of the other African countries, there's a perfectly good law that makes it illegal to hunt and sell endangered species, and chimpanzees are endangered. So when we went to the Minister of the Environment, he was quite prepared to confiscate this infant. And so I went back that evening with the wonderful Belgian woman, Graziella Kotman, and she agreed to try and nurse little Jay, as we called him, back to health. So she dug out the shotgun pellets, and she gave him good nourishing food and a lot of love and affection. She was successful. Other confiscations were made, and as a result, it became less and less frequent to see infant chimpanzees for sale. We, of course, were landed with the problem of caring for these infants. Graziella had to give up her job as her family grew, and eventually she could no longer care for these chimps in her backyard. We were fortunate in that the oil company Conoco stepped forward and offered to build a sanctuary. And I say we were fortunate because of all the oil companies exploring at that time, Conoco, without any question, had the most enlightened attitude towards the environment. And at any rate, they built us this sanctuary. And this family has now grown to 55 in number, not only confiscated by government officials, but also handed over by pets. And so what began for me as a research project in Tanzania, learning about these amazing non-human beings, has increasingly involved me in conservation projects in different parts of Africa and also in the business of looking after orphan chimpanzees, because we cannot put them back in the wild. The wild chimps are aggressively territorial. They show the loving, compassionate side of human nature, which presumably we've inherited from our ancient primate past, but they show the bad side too and can be very violent, very aggressive, and show warlike behavior, and they hate strangers. So because the young chimps also have become bonded with people, they might wander into a village if we let them free and either hurt or be hurt. So we have to care for them. We try to use these chimpanzees as ambassadors to teach the local people about these marvelous beings, part of their natural heritage. And we also employ as many of the local people as we can from the surrounding villages. We buy produce from them. We've raised money for a little primary school and a little dispensary, which we're managing to get support for from the medical school at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And the government's asked us to develop a large area around the sanctuary where there still are some remaining wild chimpanzees and some forests in this amazing savanna forest land along the coast of the Congo. It's unfortunate that most of that amazing country has gone, not to logging this time, but to Shell Oil in partnership with a local company, planting mile upon mile upon mile upon mile of eucalyptus. So it's for these reasons that I'm traveling around trying to raise awareness. In addition, the sometimes extremely cruel way that chimpanzees are treated in zoos, the cruel pre-training, harsh pre-training, beating them over the head with iron bars that is typically practiced by those training them for entertainment, whether it be circus or any other form of entertainment. And also the conditions in the medical research laboratories. Whether or not we believe it's ethical to use our closest living relatives, I think all of us would agree that to keep them in cages 5 foot by 5 foot by themselves for maybe 30, 40, or 50 years, because the longevity, the oldest chimps we know are 64 today, these are beings who've committed no crime. They may be helping to alleviate human suffering. 5 foot by 5 foot is not an appropriate prison cell for our closest living relatives. I think the question I'm asked most often as I travel around is, well, Jane, do you think there's hope? If you fly over Africa, you see the forests gone. If you travel much in any part of the world, you find this terrible poisoning, the pollution of the air and the water and the land. And on top of that, there's human greed, there's human cruelty, there's crime, there's violence, there's drugs, and there's warfare. Is there really hope for us, the planet as we know it today? There are many environmentalists who would stand and say to you that it's already too late, that even if we all change the way we behave today, we've gone so far in our overpopulating of the world and the destruction of the forest and the spread of the desert and the increasing hole in the ozone layer and all these other things that you all know about. It's too late. Imagine being on a big ship, seeing rocks ahead. Everyone rushes to turn the wheel, but by the time the ship changes course, it's too late and you're going to hit the rocks and have a shipwreck. Well, I have three reasons for hope. And I want to end off by quickly sharing those with you. First of all, my hope lies in the amazing nature of the human brain. We have an incredible intellect stuffed into our skulls up here. For heaven's sake, we've sent people onto the moon. The primitive tools used by the chimpanzees, rocks and bits of twig, have been transformed over the eras into sophisticated modern technology, much of which is tremendously improving the quality of life of people and sometimes animals around the world. It's unfortunate that we've used that same technology to create weapons of mass destruction, and also that we have used it to create so much terrible, terrible destruction of the natural world. It's our destructiveness, along with our propensity for breeding large numbers of other human beings, that is threatening the planet today. So why am I hopeful? I'm hopeful because it's relatively recently that around the world people have begun to realize that there really are environmental problems. And don't you think that with our brains we can now get together and try to find some solutions, heal some scars, live in a more environmentally friendly way? And the good news is that some companies already are moving quite fast in that direction. And companies that go green, whether they do it for ethical reasons or whether it's good PR, it really doesn't matter as long as they do it. And there are some exciting things happening. I was in Cleveland just 2 weeks ago, and I like to travel around with symbols of hope because sometimes one does get a bit despairing. And a little boy of 7 went out. In fact, his grandfather is here today. It's Philip Berman's son. He went out to Lake Erie. They live on the shore. And about, I'm not sure how many years ago, 10 years ago, 15, something like that, Lake Erie was so polluted, it was actually a fire hazard. And this piece of driftwood came from the shore of a lake where today you can catch fish and eat them without danger. So things can get a lot better. I went to Nagasaki a few years ago where the second atomic bomb was dropped that ended the Second World War. And the scientists at the time predicted that nothing would grow for at least 30 years. The green came back quickly, just as it did amazing scientists today after the eruption of Mount St. Helens. But at Nagasaki, there was one little sapling that didn't die. And it's a very strange tree today, quite large, with a very gnarled trunk and gnarled branches, with great cracks in them, black inside. But every spring, it puts forth new leaves. So this, to me, is a sign of hope. And just last week in Los Angeles, I had my first ride in an electric car. It's 100% recyclable. It doesn't put out any emissions. It was a fantastic experience to be in that car. And these are signs of hope for the future. We can do things in a way that's less damaging to the environment. I was in Sudbury in Canada. Some of you may know the nickel mining there caused the most horrendous environmental damage. And yet, when they decided about 15 years ago to make a concerted effort to bring back the environment, the natural environment, to Sudbury, they actually got a prize at the Earth Summit, Rio de Janeiro, for accomplishing a miracle. And I asked them for a symbol, and they said, well, Jane, the peregrine falcon has been reintroduced, is again nesting and flying so beautifully over our skies. So they sent me this feather, which arrived 2 weeks ago. So some of those are signs of environmental hope. But it's never going to work until you and I take responsibility for our own lives. We love to shrug off responsibility. We love to point fingers. It's not my fault, any of this. It's the fault of science. It's the fault of the politicians. Why don't they make laws? Oh, it's the fault of industry. But we're the consumers. We have tremendous power with choosing what to buy and specifically what not to buy. And this can have a very major effect on the development of environmentally friendly products and can really encourage those companies that are trying to do it right, because they need our support if they're going to compete out there on the marketplace today, a cutthroat world, as many of you know. My real fear is that we've become apathetic because of what I call just me-ism. I mean, I'm one person, there's millions of people out there, so what little I can do can't possibly make any difference. It's just me. But if we turn that around, then as more and more people become environmentally educated, you can have millions and indeed billions of people all out there saying, what I do does matter. I do matter. What I do does matter. And suddenly you'll have tremendous environmental change sweeping through our societies. And this leads me directly into my second reason for hope, which is the tremendous energy of young people. And as they become aware of environmental problems, they have all this energy that they want to direct into making the world around them a better place. I mean, they're going to grow up and have all these problems to solve, so the sooner they start helping to solve them, the better. And that led to this program I call Roots and Shoots. Roots creep under the ground to make a firm foundation. Shoots seem new and small, but to reach the light, they can break through brick walls. And let's see the brick walls as all these problems that I've mentioned that we humans have inflicted on the planet, ranging from overpopulation to crime and warfare and everything in between. Hope. Hundreds and thousands of Roots and Shoots, hundreds and thousands of young people together around the world can break through. And we have Roots and Shoots programs in some cases with preschool kids. Mostly it's middle school and high school. And a brand new group has formed itself at the university level. And they, of course, are linked by email around the world. What do? They do hands-on projects to show that they care about the environment, about people, and about animals. Three types of project. And what they do will depend on where they are, so that in rural Tanzania, for example, they plant a lot of trees, at least in the arid areas and overpopulated areas. in inner city Los Angeles, where I spent last week with the LAPD. They're sponsoring several Roots and Shoots programs there. They're trying to get rid of graffiti. They're clearing up trash. They're doing the best they can. It's a tough world there, of course, as you know. So those are the kind of projects that can be done for the environment. For animals, well, learning about them, sharing what you know, and even walking a neighbor's dog or volunteering at a shelter, somebody here from Wildlife Refuge, these kind of things. And finally, for people, well, your typical community projects. And so these groups of Roots and Shoots are now in 30 different countries, and there's more than 600 groups in North America. So this is one of my real positive hopes for the future, this energy of young people who are empowered by being given hope. And my last reason for hope lies in the fact that as I travel around the world, and I'm doing it now all the time, the longest I've been anywhere in the last 11 years is 3 weeks, I meet such amazing people. I mean, people who tackle tasks that everybody says is impossible, and yet they succeed or they blaze a trail along which others can follow. People who overcome horrific physical disabilities and live lives that are shining examples to those around them. I spent a morning about 3 weeks ago with an extraordinary person, Henry Landworth. Maybe some of you have heard of Give Kids the World. He's built a village near Disneyland in Orlando, Florida, for children who have terminal illnesses. And they go there for a week where they can meet Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, a week when they can smile and perhaps for a little while forget their pain or their fear, a week when their parents can spend time together knowing that the children are looked after by the best healthcare professionals, and a week where the brothers and sisters who felt guilty or neglected are treated with just as much love and affection by the volunteers that pour into this place. And to watch Henry interacting and the mothers hugging him and crying, and to see him playing with the children, he says, "I'm living the life that I never had," because he was a survivor of Auschwitz. And what to me is so amazing about Henry is that all the bitterness and hatred that he brought with him when he came to the United States as a young man has been transformed into compassion and love. And it was a very moving experience to be there. And all around the world are people like that. I think one of the problems is that we, you know, on our television screens and in our newspapers, we see human violence. We read about rape and crime and murder. We read about the dreadful things that people do. It's newsworthy. We read about the war and the refugees and the fighting and the gang violence. And yes, that's all there. But if we just think about our own circle, if we think about most of the people we know, aren't we sort of basically reasonably decent human beings? And it's the same all around the world, but somehow it gets blown out of proportion. So in this room, how many wonderful people are there? Many, I guarantee you, very many. You can look in the mirror in the morning, look back, I hope, at one of these wonderful people. So that my real hope lies in the fact that it's up to you and I, and we have the power if we have the hope. And I believe that as a result of the efforts of you and me, that we can expect our great-great-grandchildren to open their eyes and see blue sky and hear the birds singing, that there will be greenery, and that some of the chimps in some of the African forests will still be swinging through the trees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Goodall, for your most poignant and moving remarks. And now to direct the question and answer portion of the program will be the president of the Commonwealth Club of California, Mr. Joe Epstein. Joe?
Thanks, Mary. Thank you very much, Mary Bitterman, our quarterly chair. Dr. Goodall, we do have a large number of questions for you submitted by our audience today. And if you would return to the podium, please, I'd like to begin. At lunch, we were talking about the state of Montana, and we asked Dr. Goodall if she had been to the state of Montana, and she answered that she had not, but she would be going there shortly. Well, last summer, I went to Montana for the first time, and it was kind of humorous to listen to some of the rangers talk about what you do if you meet a bear in the woods. So this question is pertinent. This person wants to know, what advice would you give to a person about ready to meet a chimpanzee in the wild for the first time?
It would actually depend on where you were. If you were in Gombe National Park, where the chimpanzees are used to people, you would just sit very quietly and the chimpanzee would ignore you, and you'd have this amazing experience of looking into the eyes of another being, looking into a mind that you know is summing you up as well as you summing him or her up. And it would be a marvelous experience, unless you happen to meet our one bully, Frodo, who is actually quite dangerous and charges people and slaps them and hits them over. If you were about to meet a wild chimpanzee in an area where chimpanzees hadn't been studied, you would expect to see a small piece of black fur vanishing very rapidly into the undergrowth, and it would be disappointing.
It seems that the fate of the chimps is tied to the condition of man in Africa, which is beset by disease, ignorance, war, and so forth. How will the chimps survive if the Africans are doing so poorly?
I think it's for this very reason that all our efforts at conservation are directed towards working with the local people. Because quite clearly, when people are starving, when people are having to cut down forests in order to live, then there's very little hope for the wildlife there. I mentioned earlier that around Gombe National Park, all the trees had gone. We have a reforestation program that's funded by the European Union, and we also introduce conservation education, the Roots and Shoots program, and in addition to that, projects for women, so that hopefully as they rise up out of poverty, there will be a drop in the birth rate, as there is in other parts of the world, wherever women have become better educated. And we've managed to piggyback onto this. It's for us a big project. For the European Union, it's very, very tiny. But we've managed to piggyback onto it so that with every car that goes out or boat that goes along the lakeshore, there is in addition somebody to talk about family planning, somebody to talk about AIDS education, and somebody to teach primary health care. So it's only by working with the people and improving their lives with these imaginative rural development programs that we can hope to save some of the chimpanzees. And I know I was talking earlier with the rainforest, what do you call rainforest network? Action Network, Rainforest Action Network. And I know that we share much similar philosophy on ways of protecting the remaining forests.
Well, you've walked into my next question, which was going to be, how supportive are the local people for preserving animals in Africa?
We've employed people from around the Gombe National Park since 1968 to not just be trackers and guides and things like that, but actually to help us with the research. We've gradually trained them, taught some of them to read and write, and now they collect sophisticated information. They use 8mm videos also. They are proud of their work. They talk about it to their family and friends. And most important of all, they care about the chimps as individuals. And that's why, even though this little 30-square-mile park, I've said the long-term viability is in question, but the chimps there live their lives from day to day in safety. It's not so in other parts of Africa. There are 4 field studies that I know, 3 in Uganda and 1 in the Ivory Coast, where up to 50% of the adult chimpanzee population being studied has lost a hand or a foot as a result of getting caught in poachers' snares. In all the 37 years at Gombe, 1 snare for 1 chimpanzee. So,
Well, I'd like to shift gears a little bit just for a moment. San Francisco is voting on a bond issue, Proposition C, in June to rebuild the San Francisco Zoo. What is your philosophy about zoos in general? Excuse me. I think I actually said that. Freudian, for sure. What is your philosophy on zoos in general? And how do you feel we could appropriately rebuild our zoo to accommodate the mission of animals, conservation, education, and even entertainment?
Well, obviously, zoos are a kind of, you know, I have mixed feelings about zoos. And it's best to see chimpanzees out in Africa in the wild. But it depends where they are in Africa. It isn't always that you're out in the wild and life is wonderful. It's fine at Gombe, although chimps have their problems too, just as we do in their daily lives. But there are parts of Africa where I would hate to be a chimpanzee. Their trees are being cut down. They're being shot for food. They're catching their hands and feet in snares. And then you go to a really good zoo where there's a nice group of individuals who've been together for a long time. Babies are left with mothers. The zoo doesn't have an aggressive policy whereby individuals are just shipped out when they think the group's a bit big or just because another zoo wants to buy a breeding individual. And I've watched them sitting, contemplating a big male up on a branch, looking down, contemplating his females and youngsters and their grooming, and the babies are playing. And I think to myself, well, I would rather be here. So I haven't seen the plans for the San Francisco Zoo. I'm just involved in plans for the Los Angeles Zoo. But the main thing that chimpanzees need is enough space that the males can do these dramatic charging displays. They need a good social group. There should be a good policy about what happens with so-called surplus individuals. And above all, they need stimulation. They get so desperately, deadly bored because in the wild, you know, they get up, they've got all these decisions to make. They can go on a boundary patrol and the males will creep along and repel strangers, or they can go hunting, or they can wander off by themselves and lie in the shade if they feel lazy with their bellies full. And so, you see, in captivity, it's really necessary to recreate challenge in the captive environment, to give them something to use their very considerable intellect on. So I'm certainly hoping the San Francisco Zoo will be a zoo like that.
We were talking at lunch also about the fact that there would undoubtedly be many questions regarding the use of primates in medical research. And I mentioned to Dr. Goodall about the University of California at Davis, of course, which she is, and we are all very much aware of. She had informed me that UC Davis was one of seven, mind you, seven primate centers of about that size that do testing for medical research. So the question, of course, is what are your opinions on the utilization of chimps and monkeys and apes for the testing of new drugs for cures for diseases such as AIDS, cancer, and so forth?
Well, as you all know, this is a very hot kind of question. And it tends to create a good deal of tension in people who are standing on the one side or the other, the animal rights versus the medical community. And for a long time, there was actually no dialogue. I mean, I've met animal rights activists who said, how could you possibly go into the same room as the president of a university that has a large lab where animals are being tortured? But if you don't talk with people, how can you ever effect change? I personally think it was terribly arrogant of us in the first place to just think that it doesn't matter what we do to other creatures who are not human as long as it might benefit humans. Of course, the sad thing here is that we're not just limiting this to non-human animals, are we? We also perpetrate, we being the human species, we perpetrate terrible cruelty against other humans too, the in-group, out-group. But to come back to the animal issue, supposing we never had cut-up animals to see what happened. Supposing we never had tested drugs on animals. Well, you hear that there would have been very few advances in medical science if it wasn't for the use of animals. That really isn't true. And I've spent a lot of time investigating this and speaking with very serious medical historians about it. And I think the issue boils down to this. First of all, we should acknowledge and accept, all of us, whether we believe in animal experimentation or not, that it does impose sometimes very considerable suffering on these beings, whether they be chimpanzees or dogs. We should have learned by now, thanks to the chimpanzee blurring the line once seen so sharp between humans on the one hand and animals on the other, that it's not only human beings with personality capable of rational thought and, above all, capable of emotional feelings and knowing mental and physical pain. So once we are prepared to admit that, then we can start talking. What should we be doing? Well, there are already amazing alternatives to the use of living animals in medical experimentation that 10 years ago people said, well, we'll never be able to stop using animals for this kind of procedure. So one thing we can do is to make some kind of legislation that if there is an alternative and if it's been approved by the FDA, then animals should not be used for that particular procedure. That's one thing. Two, we should be putting more money, more effort, and giving more public acclaim to those people who are working in this field and do make breakthroughs. Where are the Nobel Prizes? In fact, they tend to get shunned to some extent by many of the medical establishment just because it's threatening the status quo. This is how it's always been done. This is the only way it can be done. So, obviously, if all animal experimentation was stopped tomorrow, there would be total chaos. It would lead to massive suffering. But I'm not advocating that. What I'm saying is let's not be confrontational. Let's sit down. Let's discuss solutions. And let's, above all, admit that as long as we continue to use animals, we are inflicting sometimes almost unendurable pain.
There is someone here in the audience that's in the travel business, and they submitted a very good question. They want to know what your view is in the role of tourism in East Africa in terms of animal conservation.
I'd like to extend that beyond East Africa. That's probably Abercrombie and Kent, who are mostly in East Africa. But let's extend it. Let's extend this question of tourism across Africa. It's a two-edged sword, because over-exploiting an area for tourism can be extremely damaging. And I can think of places that have been almost totally destroyed by huge numbers of tourists coming in, Africa or anywhere else. And I think you know from the American national parks that this is a big problem. However, if you have a very poor nation, like so many African nations are, and if it's deemed desirable to try and protect certain areas of wilderness, forest or plain or whatever it is, and if, for example, there is suspected mineral wealth there or oil wealth, you actually can't expect the government not to sell off this timber concession or mining concession or whatever it is. So one has to, first of all, work together with those people and see if it can be done in an environmentally friendly way like Conoco was doing. But over and above that, the more money the government has coming in as foreign exchange through tourism, the more they're prepared to listen to the desirability of setting aside land, not necessarily land with oil fields under it, that'll probably never happen, but certainly land which is threatened by human population pressures and where the local people want to take it over for grazing their cattle and so forth. If you can show that there's a revenue coming in from foreign exchange from tourism, and if some of that revenue can be directed to establishing the kind of rural development programs I talked about, then tourism has to be seen as an extremely beneficial development. And in addition to that, a constant stream of tourism, as long as it's not too great, going through an area where there's a lot of poaching, for example, again can serve as a deterrent to poaching. It makes a presence, and that can only be beneficial.
We are running a little short of time, and I want to try to group some questions together here about the traits of chimpanzees. I know you mentioned how human-like they are in so many ways. There's a question here about violence in the chimpanzee society. Another one on the emotional life of chimpanzees. Here's a real interesting one. It's the likelihood of interspecies communication. Could you try to comment on those, please?
Well, that's a tall order, isn't it? Chimpanzee violence. Chimpanzees can be extremely violent. As I said, they have a dark side to their nature. The males fight more than the females. The males are the dominant sex. The males fight most often in competition for social rank, who's going to come out above who. And you remember I said there's lots of similarities in humans and chimpanzees in all kinds of ways. So chimpanzees can be very violent. They have a wonderful mechanism in place for restoring harmony to the social group after a violent episode, and that is that the victim, even though very fearful, may have been thrashed by a big male, will very often approach that aggressor and make some kind of submissive posture or gesture, reaching out a hand, turning and crouching, screaming and whimpering. And usually the aggressor will then reach out and reassure the supplicant, patting, embracing, or kissing. So there is violence, but we don't see real savage violence very often, just occasionally when males are fighting each other for social dominance, and inter-community violence when one group of males is attacking an individual from a neighboring community. That can be extremely violent, the worst violence we've ever seen, this hatred of strangers. What was the other thing you wanted me to comment on? Males, violence, where was the other one? Interspecies? Interspecies communication, maybe the question here was getting at the fact that chimpanzees in captivity can be taught human-like languages, and they can learn many of the signs of American Sign Language, as can gorillas. You had a very famous signing gorilla right here in San Francisco with Penny Patterson's Coco. And the chimpanzees can learn 300 or more signs, communicate with each other in social groups, as well as with their trainer, although they do tend to fall back into chimpanzee, not surprisingly, unless they're being specifically asked to do things. And one young chimpanzee who was never taught anything by a human, nevertheless acquired from his companions, who were all American Sign Language chimps, 56 words by the time he was 8 years old, and he wasn't taught anything by any human. Out in the wild, chimpanzees and baboons have amazing interspecific communication, and certainly we understand most of what the chimpanzees are meaning with their postures, gestures, and calls. And the next one was emotional life. Well, I think we sort of touched on that. There's no question but that young chimpanzees and young human children look just about the same when they show joyful, happy behavior, and they show joyful, happy behavior in the same kind of context. When they're out playing in the dirt, when they've got good food in front of them, they behave in the same kind of way. They behave very similarly, too, when they're upset and sad and distressed. And also, as I've described, a chimpanzee may actually die of grief in the case of losing a mother.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time for any more questions, and I would just like to say in closing, Dr. Goodall, that speakers who grace the Commonwealth Club podium receive a one-year membership in our club. You will be receiving your membership shortly. And you have impressed me, and I'm sure over 500,000 people and listeners listen to our radio broadcast weekly hearing today's program. And I'd like to make this commitment to you that I will join the Jane Goodall Institute personally, and I would encourage our Commonwealth Club members and our guests who are here today to consider doing the same. We all need to support your efforts in the environment, with animals, and in community issues. Thank you very much. Our thanks to Dr. Jane Goodall, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute for Wildlife Research education, and conservation for speaking to us today. And thanks to all of you for attending today's program. And I invite you to join us again soon for another meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the nation's premier public affairs forum. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.